We're coming this morning to Genesis chapter 38, the story of Jacob and Tamar. I'm sorry, I wrote Jacob on my notes. Isn't that ridiculous? Okay, I hope this is not a sign of things to come. Judah and Tamar. In the last chapter, in verse 3 of chapter 37, we read this. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age. You might say, well, wasn't Benjamin the son of his old age? He's younger than Joseph. But clearly Jacob was his favorite. And the last two times I've taken us to 1 Chronicles 5, verses 1 and 2, so you don't need to turn there again, but just by way of reminder, Joseph replaced Reuben, the firstborn, in terms of the birthright. He was Jacob's favorite, and he was chosen by Jacob. Remember, Reuben had disqualified himself by lying with Bilhah, Rachel's maid. Simeon and Levi were disqualified because of the slaughter at Shechem. Even though Jacob favored Joseph in his prophecy, I'll go there again because this is just worth the reminder. In his prophecy in chapter 49, and he is speaking prophetically, the chapter opens in verse 1, Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, Assemble yourselves, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the days to come. And he lays out prophecies for his sons. And in this chapter, in these prophetic utterances, he begins with Judah in verse 8. But down in verse 10, still speaking of Judah, he says prophetically, in spite of his choice of Joseph to receive the birthright and be the head of the family, he says of Joseph in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Well, the scepter is definitely the reign, the rule, kingship, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. So this is a prophecy of Messiah, and that Messiah would come through Judah, and that Judah would be the house of the kings. So the future history of Israel is laid out prophetically, even though Jacob, in his own mind and heart, prefers Joseph. So that's kind of the setup here. The rest of Genesis, the last chapters of Genesis from, it's not that many, is it? A couple more. But the rest of Genesis is occupied with Joseph and the end of his life, and of course Jacob's end as well. And what Joseph appears to have done is exactly what his father Isaac did. Isaac preferred Esau and chose Esau for the birthright because he was the firstborn. But God chose Jacob. Jacob chose Joseph, but God chose Judah. And we see this happening, and this is established. Now, because we're interrupting the story of Joseph in our chapter 38, so the story of Joseph has already begun. We're interrupting that story then in chapter 38. To consider Judah. So this is, one commentator called it a parenthetical insertion in Joseph's story. But it establishes the messianic genealogy through the tribe of Judah, whatever Joseph's or Jacob's preferences were. It does happen to be true that if you look at the birth order, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, Judah is next in line. Rightfully, if you do things according to custom and tradition. And you can almost imagine that with Joseph now assumed to be dead, they've seen, you know, his father has seen his blood on that very colored tunic, so he's certain that he's been devoured by beasts. And Judah is actually the next one in line according to birth order. You can almost imagine Leah having a little input here. No, her first three sons have been disqualified. She would have an interest in seeing the birthright go to one of her sons. So that's a little bit of intro before we start. So let's go ahead and look at chapter 38 of Genesis. Verse 1, "And it came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira." At that time. I'm assuming, I mean, it's kind of an assumption, it's certainly within the 22 years when Joseph is away and considered by his father and mother to be dead. But I'm gonna assume that this is probably pretty soon after Joseph was sold into slavery. I'll come back to that thought in a minute. Adullam is a small Canaanite town northwest of Hebron, and depending what commentary you read, it's just a mile from Hebron, or it's 8 miles from Hebron, or 13 miles from Hebron, or it's 15 miles from Hebron. So take your choice there. Gail did find Adullam on a map. I don't have it on any of my study maps in my study Bible, but Gail found it, and it looks like it's one of those longer distances, 8, 13, or 15 miles to the northwest. It's nearby enough that they would pasture their animals in the same fields some of the time. Hira is a Canaanite buddy of young Judah. These guys are pals. They've made friends. Remember, Judah is probably a fairly young fellow at this point. We've found someone who's willing to commit that he was not more than 4 years older than Joseph. So a fairly young man at this part. About point. Then it also said that Judah departed from his brothers. And remembering the important special role that Judah played in the dispatch of his brother Joseph, he was the one, they had wanted to kill him, and some of them wanted to do it, and the older brother didn't want to do it. And it was Judah who was the one who said, "Let's not kill him, let's make some money off of him. Here come the camels, will sell him to this caravan and they can take him to Egypt and sell him as a slave." So he played an important role, but whatever part any of these brothers played, you can imagine that they're a bit uncomfortable about it, especially in connection with Jacob's inconsolable grief. When he gets the news that Joseph, his favorite, is dead, he is beyond being comforted. And the brothers all may feel a bit awkward. Certainly there's a sense of shame around this. And, you know, they're just maybe not as close and friendly as they might have been before. Verse 2, and I'll read down through 5. Judah saw there in this little town, Adullam, a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. This daughter gets referenced a couple of times in the passage, but only in this way, never by name. She's never identified by name. She's just the daughter of Shua. "And he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Shelah, and it was at Chezlib that she bore him. So they've moved now slightly south to a little neighboring village when she has her third son. Let me read a note from Henry Morris's book. Actually, he did not go far from the family headquarters, and certainly not beyond the circuit within which they took their flocks for pasture. Adullam, where he went, was not nearly so far away as Shechem or Dothan. Adullam was a small and long-established Canaanite settlement about 8 miles, northwest of the family home. Judah also was evidently looking for a wife. He realized it would be essentially impossible for him or his brothers to find a wife among Laban's people, as Isaac and Jacob had been able to do, since they were now as far gone in idolatry as the rest of the world. Esau's family also was now a mixture of Semitic and Canaanite stock, as was Ishmael's. These young men, if they don't marry immediately within their tribal group, which is not that big at this point, they have nowhere to go for wives except to look at the neighboring peoples. God could lead Judah to a suitable bride anywhere, of course, and she could be taught to know and serve the true God in order to be a proper mother for the kingly line which would come through him. This is a circumstance, and as it unfolds, you see the danger in it. This is every bit as dangerous to Israel as a people as that ordeal at Shechem between Dinah and the prince of the city, Shechem. There is a distinct threat that the descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob are going to be absorbed into the Canaanite communities around them. They'll be a mixed descent and just sort of absorbed. Now, we'll see how that develops as we go here. But God is going to prevent that from happening. It's already happening, and we'll see it here. Well, in fact, let me go on just a little bit. I stopped at verse 5. That's fine. God interrupts this mixing with the Canaanite peoples by the whole migration to Egypt. The Canaanites are happy to intermarry with the Hebrews, but that's not true of the Egyptians. They look down on the Hebrew people. They consider themselves to be ethnically and religiously and culturally superiors, and then they loathe shepherds, and that's all they do here almost, is they're shepherds. So the Egyptians don't want to intermarry with the Hebrews, and it appears to be God's solution to the problem that we're seeing develop here. Verses 6 and 7, now Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. You see that already in the first generation of intermarriage between, in this case, Judah and the Canaanites, Israel is being lost. We don't know specifically exactly what it was that did or didn't do that was evil in the sight of the Lord, but you can assume that he was not emulating his father Judah or his grandfather Isaac or his great-grandfather Abraham. Did I say that right? Okay, anyway, he's not emulating Israel. He's a Canaanite, and so that becomes a problem, and so the Lord took his life. And then we flip the page in my case to verse 8. I'll read 8 through 10. Then Judah said to Onan, that's the second born of his sons, go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother. Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. What we have here is something we recognize later in the law of Moses in relation to the people of Israel, but it also is apparently a common custom in the people of the lands with some differences. So Kyle and Delitzsch has a little offering on this subject. The custom of levirate marriage, which is first mentioned here and is found in different forms among Indians, Persians, and other nations of Asia and Africa, was not founded upon a divine command, but upon an ancient tradition originating probably in Chaldea. It was not abolished, however, by the Mosaic law, Deuteronomy 25:5-10, but only so far restricted as not to allow it to interfere with the sanctity of marriage. And with this limitation, it was enjoined as a duty of affection to build up the brother's house and to preserve his family and name. Judah then wished Onan, as the brother-in-law, to marry the childless widow of his deceased brother and raise up seed, i.e. a family, for him. But as he knew that the firstborn son would not be the founder of his own family, but would perpetuate the family of the deceased and receive his inheritance, he prevented conception when consummating the marriage. There's every reason, I think, to believe that he kept Tamar as wife for a time, but that was his habitual practice because he didn't want her child to receive the family inheritance instead of himself. If his brother is dead and has no sons, and no sons can be, you know, provided, then the birthright and inheritance will be his. And so for that reason, he did not want to do this. He was quite willing to have Tamar as a wife, but he took great care that she would not be pregnant. This is a deliberate rebellion on his part. It's for selfish reasons. But it would be something that Judah would not know about. This is his own secret. Remember that it was Judah, back in verse 6, now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. That probably would have been an arrangement made between Tamar's father and Judah, a contractual arrangement in order to get Tamar as a wife for his son. And the terms of that contract are kind of a part of what's going on in this chapter. So Ur and Onan are both dead. They were displeasing to the Lord, and the Lord took their lives. Verse 11. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I am afraid that he too may die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Now, rightfully, she should have remained in Judah's house, and then he should have, as soon as his younger son was old enough to marry, which may have only been 2 or 3 years, he should have then given her to him. But it seems like parents often blame others for their children's problems. Anybody ever hear of such a thing? Rather than holding their own children responsible, Judah has this duty to Tamar and her father, but he fears that this death of his first two sons is somehow Tamar's fault, that she's the reason, and that if he gives his third son, his last son, his only son at this point, the same might happen to him. He's probably a little too young to marry. Don't think we're waiting decades at this point. Maybe two, 3 years, several years for him to be of marriageable age. They married quite young in those days. So Judah sends Tamar back to her father, a childless widow, a desperate circumstance for a woman in these ancient times. She, unless her father takes care of her now for the rest of her life, she has really kind of no hope for income, survival, or anything if she's not associated with a husband or a son. She's a childless widow. It's a desperate circumstance. Verse 12. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, again, no name, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. Considerable time I'm taking to mean whatever passage of time was required for Shelah to reach marriageable age. Several years, perhaps. He's, after the passage of this considerable time, he's old enough to marry. I don't know, the mention of the time of mourning passing seems to be kind of casual, almost incidental, and especially juxtaposed to what sheep shearing is. You remember some of the stories about shearing time, the great celebrations. It's also a time of great profit and income for shepherds. The wool buyers are notified and they show up, and it's a real festival-like atmosphere. There's feasting and drinking, probably shearing contests with great prizes, lots of celebration, music, dancing. The single girls show up. This is a great time to turn out to an event. It's party time. A kind of a sheep rodeo. Oh, rodeos. Back in 1975, we just had moved up here from Monterey, and we had made the decision that on a trip to visit my parents in Michigan and Gail's family in Texas, that we would go to Denver and visit the Conservative Baptist Seminary there. We met Dr. Vernon Grounds. Actually, Gail spent more time with him than I did. She was talking to him about a master's degree in counseling and so on. So we started out from here, and what a skinflint I was in those days. Am I any better now? We drove 33 hours nonstop trying to make it to Denver without having to rent a motel room. It was awful. We were both hallucinating. A leaf would blow out on the road. It was terrible. And after 33 hours of driving, we were entering Cheyenne, Wyoming. And we said, oh, we got to stop. Let's get a room. We'll get a motel. And we pulled off the freeway and drove right into the center of Frontier Days. Anybody ever hear of that? They bill Frontier Days as the world's largest outdoor rodeo. It lasts 10 days. And we got off the freeway. Not only could we not find a room, any motel sign you saw was, full, but you couldn't even make your way down the surface streets. They were just packed with people, drinking beer in their cowboy hats and boots and stuff. We found our way back onto the freeway, drove to the I-80 turnoff to go south to Denver, and at the first rest stop, we just pulled off and tilted our seats back and slept as best we could in the car. Anyway, this was probably a little bit smaller affair than Frontier Days, but it would still be a great celebration, and it's just kind of an interesting bookend around that thought of a time of mourning. So Judah and his pal Hira, the Canaanite, are having a sheep shearing. You know, it's their own flocks and stuff, so it's going to be a source of income, but also a good time. Verses 13 and 14. It was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." And they all know what a sheep shearing is all about. It's similar in some ways to the farmers who would winnow their grain at the threshing floor, and they would have similar kinds of celebrations around that. It's a time of benefit and profit and fun for everyone. So somebody, and we don't know who, informs Tamar that Judah will be holding a sheep shearing in Timnah. So she removed her widow's garments, which illustrates that she'd been following instructions. She's living as a widow in her father's house according to Judah's instructions. But now she's wise. She removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil, which was the mark of a temple prostitute at that time, and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife. So she kept her part of the bargain, but Judah did not. He does not want Shelah to have this woman as a wife. Maybe he thinks she's, you know, a jinx or whatever, but you know, he's already lost two sons who were with her, and he doesn't want to take that chance again. Another interesting note from Morris. Considering her Canaanite background, in which promiscuity was practically a way of life, one should not condemn her actions too severely. Even the profession of temple prostitute was considered respectable. It is known that in many such ancient religious systems, all the women of the community were expected to devote themselves on occasion to this practice. As an actual, that's why they wore a veil, so then, you know, they could return to their normal life and not be identified. As an actual, they did this as an actual votive offering to their pagan gods and goddesses. That she was actually posing as such a temple prostitute rather than as a common harlot is evident from the fact that the word used to describe her later by the Canaanite men themselves, Kadesha, meaning one set apart, is used in verses 21 and 22, and was the word used for this purpose. Furthermore, her motive in so doing was neither lust nor money, but rather ensuring her place in the covenant family. And you could imagine that in the negotiations between Judah and herself and her father, that the story of the covenant relationship with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was part of the pitch to win this girl as a wife for his son. And she cares about this, apparently. This is the motive for what she's doing. She wants to have a child by Judah. For which she had, ensuring her place in the covenant family for which she had so long longed, but which it seemed was about to be denied her. She was surely no ordinary harlot. It must also be recognized that the biblical record itself does not condemn or criticize her. And that's kind of interesting. Indeed, her decision and her action at this point did accomplish exactly what she intended, for she became the mother of the ancestor of King David, and eventually of the Messiah. The significance of her action is that she believed in this covenanted relationship between the descendants of Jacob, including Judah, and his son and Onan, his sons, and Onan. She believed in this. She embraced it. Apparently, you could characterize this as an act of faith, even though it's utterly immoral. I don't know about saying any more on that subject. But it's a challenge. You know, when you read this, it comes right to mind. You think, what's going on here? But these are not Aesop's fables here with a moral, you know, how to be good or something. So anyway, I'll just leave it there. One other thing that's remarkable here in verses 13 and 14 is that she's utterly confident. She proceeds with a certainty that Judah is going to be an easy mark. This is not a problem. She's going to be able to entice him. So, verses 15 through 18. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here now, let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" He said, "Therefore I will send you a young goat from the flock." She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal, your cord, and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Now, a pledge is collateral. He's promised something, but if he leaves without leaving anything behind, something probably more valuable than the pledge, than the item promised in payment, what assurance could she possibly have that he would ever follow through and bring the young goat, which was to be her payment? So the pledge is collateral, and it's worth more, at least to Judah, but I'm sure it would be to anyone, than a young goat would be. It's just an assurance of payment. But she really doesn't care about payment. She wants what Judah promised, a son and a place in the family of this prominent nobleman, which would be how she would regard him. His seal and cord and staff say more about him than I realized until we started to dig into this a little bit. The seal is a mark of family leadership, or a clan leadership. The seal was something that would only be possessed by chieftains. It was all of these items were ornate and decorative, and they were displayed prominently with pride. The seal was a cylinder with engraving on it that you could roll in any soft medium, clay or wax or something. And it would leave this unique, distinctive impression, which was as good as a signature, from a chieftain. So that seal was of more importance than I realized. And it was worn prominently on decorative cordage. Apparently, this whole business of asking for essentially three forms of ID was prominent in ancient Canaanite culture. One of the commentators said that it was prominent in Ugaritic literature, which means ancient Canaanite literature, I guess. The staff is another key component of this assurance that he's leaving with her, this pledge. And the staff would have been for a chieftain like Judah, a clan leader. I think these are evidences that he has emerged in the family as a clan leader. The staff would have been a beautifully handcrafted, unique item, and probably with a tribal or family insignia. So this again is positive identification. It can't be mistaken. It's just not a stick that somebody walks with. This is something unique and basically is positive, is better than photo ID, you know. So just the possession, especially of this seal, but of all of these items, the way the seal was being displayed and her request to hold his staff as a surety, these are indications that Judah has been recognized by Jacob as the family head. The other brothers would not have carried these kinds of items. This required, you know, recognition as the family head. Remembering, of course, that as far as Jacob is concerned, Joseph is dead, and probably with some encouragement from Leah, her fourth son is now in line for the birthright and blessing and position of patriarchal leadership in the family. In verse 19, I'll read down through 23. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. He asked the men of her place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enaim?" But they said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her." And furthermore, the men of the place said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep them. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her." So Judah is trying to console himself. He wanted those items back. They were worth a lot more to him than a goat. He would have given her several goats or a bunch of goats not to lose these items. But he tried to make the payment that was promised, and she could not be found. It's just too embarrassing to pursue it any further. Even if his friend asks on his behalf, what is he going to do? Try to investigate and track down this temple prostitute? And they're always veiled just so you can't know who they are. It's impossible. Impossible. And he just fears becoming a laughingstock in the whole region if he keeps trying to locate a temple prostitute. So he's going to just have to give this up. Verse 24. Now it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry." Then Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." He demands the very strictest punishment for this woman who has brought shame upon the family name. I don't even need to talk about that, do I? My goodness. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Whoa. I love a note in Bill McDonald's commentary here. Actually, he's quoting someone else. Bill quotes Walter C. Wright in this description of this vivid scene. The companions of Judah bring him word that his daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. His judgment is quick and decisive. Let her be burned. There is neither hesitation nor compromise. As he utters this fearful sentence, we cannot detect even a tremor in his voice. The Israelitish society must be preserved from such folly and wickedness. The word goes out. The day is fixed. The preparations go forward. The stake is planted. The pile is arranged. The procession forms. The crowd gathers. The woman walks to her apparent doom. But she bears in her hands the tokens. The pledges are with her. She carries the staff and the ring. And the staff is the staff of Judah. And the ring is his ring. The pledge becomes, the pledges become the accusation of her judge. Just what a moment this is. There is no one who could mistake this ring and staff. He's exposed. You know, let her be burned. Oh, it was me. So this is really an important moment for him. And verse 26 is maybe the heart of this chapter. Judah recognized them. And he didn't say, not mine, these ain't my pants. You know, that was in my pocket, but it isn't mine. You've seen cop shows on TV. He doesn't do that. This is significant. Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. This is not a comment on morality, and Judah wouldn't be fit to make one if it was. He's not commenting on her morality. Was she a prostitute or even his own in that sense? But in terms of the family tree, in terms of the covenant relationship, she has more concern about the covenant that God has made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and is passing now through Judah, than he is. You know, he probably pitched this back in verse 6 when he negotiated to get her as a wife for his son, you know, in discussions with her and with her father. And many of the commentators actually see this whole business as an act of faith in the promises and the original contract as explained by Judah in verse 6, probably. It's not explicitly there. But this is characterized as an act of faith on Tamar's part. She wants to be to take her promised position in this specially covenanted family that has this special relationship with God. She wants that. And also, many see this as the moment in Judah's life when he demonstrates faith. Instead of trying to deny that these are his items, which he couldn't do, anyone in the crowd would recognize them. But instead of trying somehow to mitigate his own guilt and, you know, put the blame on her, he also, you know, stands up here. And some think this is the moment when he exhibits faith in the covenant promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is the moment when Judah and Tamar step into the messianic genealogy. It's an amazing moment in history. You can't give credit to them except that God opened their eyes and drew them in. Then verses 27 through 30, just to close out the chapter, it came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first, wanting to be careful because firstborn is a very important matter. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. People really go on the scarlet thread, thing and make a lot out of it. And I wish I could, too. It's a wonderful opportunity to say something. I just don't know what to make out of it, because both of these sons are listed in the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. Only Perez is listed in the genealogy of Joseph, but both are listed in Mary's genealogy. And we're left with this. Tamar, through an act of prostitution and incest with her father-in-law, Judah, has made both of them links in the genealogical chain from Abraham to Jesus. Luke 3 is the genealogy of Mary. No. Matthew 1 is Mary. Luke 3 is Joseph. And so he's Joseph's son. Jesus is Joseph's son by adoption, and only identifies Perez and Judah in that genealogy. But there's Perez, one of the twin sons. So I'll just wrap this up. These really are not to be read, and it's hard not to sometimes read these as if they're morality tales, like Aesop's fables, each one with a little moral, be good enough for God or some such thing. And the only moral here seems to be that sinners are saved by believing God, by believing the Word of God. So believe God, be forgiven, and be saved. In terms of morals, how to be a better person, Jesus touched on that in Mark 10:18. When he said, no one is good except God alone. So there are difficulties when we read these stories, but the message seems to be clear, and it's a message of grace and mercy. I'll just close with one more quote. I've so much enjoyed Morris's book in this study of Genesis. Tamar had the distinction of being one of the few women whose names are listed in the official genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1. Her name shows up in verse 3. The others were Rahab, Ruth, and the one who had been wife of Uriah, that is, Bathsheba. It is remarkable that all four of these women were not Jews, who had been won by other witnesses to the true faith of Jehovah. Tamar was a Canaanite, Rahab a native of Jericho, and thus presumably also a Canaanite. Ruth was a Moabitess, and Bathsheba probably a Hittite, at least by marriage to Uriah, if not by birth. Each of the four came into the family of Judah and Israel by morally dubious means. Tamar posed as a prostitute in order to become pregnant by Judah. Rahab was a harlot by profession until she married Salmon after the Israelites captured Jericho. Ruth persuaded Boaz to marry her by the questionable device of spending the night with him as he slept intoxicated on the threshing floor. We got a lot of heroes in the Bible. And Bathsheba became wife of King David by first committing adultery with him. Yet in spite of the apparently unsavory past of these women, each one became a strong and faithful believer in God. And God signally honored them by placing them in the genealogical line of the Messiah. And these are the only women named in either genealogy. Mary, who lived all of her life under the gossip, the stigma that her son was illegitimate. And Jesus lived with that during his public ministry. The one who was in her early life probably the most irreligious and carnal of all of them, Rahab, has actually been included by the Holy Spirit in the great catalog of the heroes of faith in Hebrews 11, verse 31. Isn't that something? Amazing. What a marvelous testimony to God's grace and the truth that God forgives past sins and brings new life. Father, we thank you often for giving a revelation of yourself to the world, a revelation given in writing. But I thank you this morning that my story is not in this book. That my youthful days were not accurately recorded for all to see. And so as we look at these folks, it's easy for us, as Judah had been toward Tamar, to get self-righteous. But we don't want to get caught up in that. What we want to notice is your grace and mercy to sinners. And that's why we're here. We thank you that you loved us enough to promise humanity since the Garden of Eden that you would send help. You would rescue people, your people. And you've revealed to us that you've known us from before the foundation of the earth. Before your first act of physical creation, you knew each of us in your heart. We were designed by you before anything was made. And so as you work out in each of our lives, the character, the qualities, the uniqueness that makes each one of us a different one of your children. We have to accept the pathway that's laid before us. Help us to cooperate with you. Help us to walk in fellowship with you. Keep us walking in your Spirit. Which means help us, like Judah, to recognize and own our sin quickly, to repent, and to be reunited with you. We ask these things in Jesus' name and for His glory.